I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, too many people are having too few babies, and this is a global problem. Somehow the world went from worrying about overpopulation to the threat of depopulation. There is now a sustained decline in birth rates, falling below the replacement level of 2.1 children. The United States, the birth rate is 1.6 and falling. Blaming culture, birth control, wealth, religion, family structure, that doesn't apply because this is happening almost everywhere on the planet. So is this a mystery? Why so few babies? And efforts by nations to change this trend by providing grants and pro-family services have had minor impacts and not solved the problem. So what does this depopulation trend look like in the long run? Why do you think this is happening? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the Marvel Avengers movies, the big villain was Thanos. He wanted to wipe out half the universe's population because of scarcity of resources. He was worried about overpopulation, and there was a huge blockbuster special effects battle to stop him. But what Iron Man could have done, rather than fighting over the Infinity Gauntlet, was given him a Thanos, a copy of the book After the Spike, Population, Progress, and the Case for People. The book lays out that the problem isn't overpopulation, but depopulation, and that's a threat just as scary, but Captain America cannot punch. We're joined by the author of After the Spike, Michael Geruso. And Michael, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me.
So is that one of the problems in making this case, is that people are still stuck on that idea that we are living with this population bomb, something that came into popular consciousness in 1968?
Yeah, so I think that's right. I think many of us are still living in the shadow of Paul Ehrlich's 1968 book and ideas that were, you know, swimming in the same waters at the time, which is that there's too many people on the planet. Population growth is something that is going to make life worse for each of us. And that, you know, according to Ehrlich and the population doomers of that movement, that humanity is just constantly on the brink of destroying itself and starving itself and dividing up what the world can offer so thinly to impoverish each of us by having too many babies. But that just has not been the case. You know, 60 years almost have passed since The Population Bomb, this book by Paul Ehrlich that predicted doom of every kind. And the population has about doubled since then. And this big world that we're living in is richer than ever, has less famine than ever, has longer and healthier lives than ever, higher levels of education than ever. So I think the population doomers of the 20th century really got something wrong there. And what we're hoping to do in our book is outline the facts rather than just the fears about what other people on the planet mean for each of us, and to correct the record on what's likely to happen in the coming decades in terms of population sizes.
Our phone number, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can call in with your questions and comments. So why do you think we're running out of people? We're not running out of people, but maybe slowly, I don't know, there are fewer people maybe in this trend that we're having, and what does that look like? Give us a call, 833-877-8255. So let's turn that phrase on you, Michael. You were talking about overpopulation doomers. Are you a depopulation doomer?
No, I'm not a depopulation doomer, but I do think it's important to get the facts straight. So let me try to lay out some of those. Today, global depopulation is the most likely future. And what I mean by depopulation is that every decade, every generation, once the world turns the corner, the world population will shrink. That's the path that we're on. That's not projected to start tomorrow or even the next decade, but it's also not that distant. The world's population size is projected to peak within 6 decades, according to the United Nations, or a couple decades sooner than that, according to demographers and researchers at other institutions like the University of Washington, who project the peak in the 2060s. And I think it's important to understand what comes after we hit that peak. It's not that once we hit that peak, the world will plateau at some population and sort of sail on there forever. What will happen is that the same low birth rates that are currently slowing population growth and will eventually result in peak population will cause population to begin declining generation after generation. And here's the reason why I think that's important to pay attention to. Once that begins, there's no automatic stabilizers. There's no reason to expect that it will automatically reverse. The world could get smaller and smaller, generation after generation. And you know, just to put this in some perspective, what do I mean by the sort of getting smaller each generation? Well, today, you know, the birth rates in the United States are about 1.6, which means roughly 1.6 children for every two adults. That's pretty common birth rate among the rich world today. So Europe as a whole has a birth rate of 1.4. Latin America as a whole has a birth rate of 1.8. But any number less than two means that in the next generation, there are not enough children to replace two parents in the prior generation. And let me just give a sense of how quickly things can change with birth rates below two. So let's take China, for example. And China is a bit of an extreme example with a birth rate of one kid per two parents. But that math ends up being pretty easy to do in our heads. So if there are 100 people in the first generation, then for every two of those, there's going to be one in the next generation. So 50 people in the second generation, and then halving again in the third generation, so 25 people. And what that means is that over the course of just two generations, the cohort sizes of people go from 100 to 25, or a 75% reduction, right? That's a very fast and important change that society will be living through. And it's even fast with birth rates that are common today in places like the US, Europe, Latin America, with a birth rate of 1.5, which is the average birth rate in the 115 or so richest countries. It's a little bit above Europe's birth rate, a little bit below the US's current birth rate. At that birth rate, within two generations, population cohort sizes would shrink by almost half. So it's a very fast change. And this should be a moment that we ask the question, is that sort of change something that we should welcome? Or should we want something else to happen? For example, a stable population rather than an ever-declining population. And so that's what we're interested in. That's the question that we want to confront in our book. That's the conversation that we want to start and to switch this narrative from worries about overpopulation, which just isn't going to happen, to the question of should we want endless depopulation to happen?
And so really quickly, because I got to go to a break, but what would you say is the perfect population number we should shoot for the planet?
I have no idea. I don't think anyone has any idea. It's sort of like asking, what's the right number of doctors in a society? What's the right number of teachers?
More.
It depends. Yeah, well, I think the way to think about it is there are going to be some things that are going to be hard to achieve in a very small world. And I'd love to dive into some details on that.
Yeah, so, but it's not, is it the who's having babies, who's not having babies? It's the pace of having babies as well. You know, you talk about generation, but what is, you know, time scale? What does that look like, you know, and why is this happening? So we're going to be diving into that. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I'm going to get Bennett on the air, and if you want to call in, I'll get you on the air right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
The House has voted to cut federal funding for public media. It costs $1.60 per person each year, and this funding is essential to keeping stations like TPR strong. That support powers local news, cultural coverage, and the emergency alerts that keep you safe. The Senate votes next, and you can contact your senators every day until they do. Ask them to vote no. Go to tpr.org/resiliency to take action today.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book After the Spike, Population, Progress, and the Case for People, a breakdown, a discussion of what's happening with depopulation on the planet. We're joined by Dr. Michael Caruso and your co-author. Let's give your co-author a shout out, Dean Spears, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And y'all are both at UT Austin?
Yes, we're both associate professors of economics at UT Austin, and we're in the Population Research Center here as well. And we've been working together for a long time.
And so, I mean, a lot of people have made the case that we have to worry about depopulation because we're concerned about propping up Social Security and not having enough young people to, support the economy. That's not what this book is about. You're talking about people. We need people. We need another Mozart. We need another Willie Nelson. We need people like that. And if you have fewer people, then you have less genius. Is that it?
Well, you know, the geniuses matter, and I wouldn't want to say that geniuses don't matter, and I feel very lucky that I get to live in a world to experience the music of Willie Nelson. But it's actually not just geniuses. So, one of the things, first, it's exactly right that you say that the book isn't about, fears about funding Social Security or, balancing the government's books in an aging society. Those things matter. There are people that are rightly concerned about the details of those things. I don't think that's actually the biggest story that's unfolding right now. And the biggest story that's unfolding is not something to do with any particular country or any particular generation, but it's humanity as a whole and over the long run. So the idea that geniuses matter, is connected to this notion that one of the things that we get from other people, one of the reasons that we're lucky to live in a big world with many people and lucky to live in a time in history that comes after a big population has already existed, is that other people have had the ideas, innovations, improvements, including marginal improvements, that have made life better for each of us. So, why are our lives better today than people lived 200 years ago? Why do we have shoes on our feet and glasses to correct our vision and, a full library of songs by Willie Nelson, but also plenty to eat, climate-controlled work environments, shorter work days, well-constructed homes to keep us warm and dry, artificial intelligence in our pocket? It's the same dirt underneath our feet that people had decades or centuries or millennia ago. It's the same sun shining overhead. The difference is that we know better what to do with these things. Knowledge is the difference. So we know how to extract the minerals and make glass and computer chips and solar panels, for example. We know how to farm more efficiently so that fewer people have to do the work that can feed more of us. And we can farm more calories, more food on the same plot of land. And we can do it in a way that is more resilient to disease and so that we have less economic precarity and less risk of famine. All of these improvements came from people. And so, yes, geniuses have played a role in that, but also just many, many people contributing to this endlessly renewable resource of ideas. Knowledge is a special kind of economic resource. It's a resource that we can use over and over and over again without depleting it, without diminishing it. So, for example, once you heal a child who has a bacterial infection with an antibiotic pill, that pill is gone forever. No one will ever eat that pill again. But the knowledge of how to combat bacterial infections, the production process for how to mass produce that pill, the underlying germ theory of disease to understand what a bacterial infection is in the first place, all of those remain undiminished to be used over and over and over again. And here's the connection with population. It's people that have made those discoveries that make life better for each of us. It's people that had to do that. Progress doesn't just happen automatically because the clock ticks forward one day or one year or one decade. People have to achieve it. And so in a future world with many fewer people, not just geniuses, but everybody who's contributing every day to push things a little bit further forward, we stand to lose an important source of some of that progress.
Yeah, we don't want the recipe for antibiotics to go the way the recipe for Roman concrete went. Like, how did they do that? We don't know. And so that knowledge isn't locked in people. You lose people, you lose information, and that's something to guard against. Let's go to a caller, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Bennett. And Bennett, you're on the air.
Well, thank you. Well, I think the answer is obvious. It's the Women's Liberation idea. Women now don't want to get married. They want to have careers. They don't want to have children. And if they do have children, after 6 months, they drop them off in the daycare center. We've turned our whole human condition on its end, and we're complaining about the result. When women got the right to vote, the family system started to go downhill. If you don't have families, you don't have children. So you got to get off this women's liberation idea. Women have to go back to their normal roles of being housewives, mothers, and teachers, and men have to do the work. Otherwise, you're going to have nobody. You'll have animals running the earth.
All right, Bennett, thank you for that. Michael, is that the problem? Should we go back to enslaving half the population to become birth people?
No, we shouldn't. And let's open this up a little bit, because, you know, this is something we have now, having written this book and had many, many conversations with people from all over the political spectrum and with all sorts of perspectives they're bringing to this, you know, come up with many, many explanations that seem clear to them as the answer for why birth rates are low. So let's take on this idea that it's feminism in particular, or women's liberation, or, you know, the opening of culture, politics, the economy.
Well, let's just stick to the idea of the woman issue question, because you talk about this in the book, and you lay out that is not the solution.
No, it's certainly not. And, you know, first, one thing that's really useful is you can look around the world. The world has a lot of variety in it, including in terms of women's rights, including in terms of the role that women play in society. And in all of these diverse places, birth rates are low or falling. So South Korea, for example, South Korea is no feminist paradise. It's a deeply unequal society. South Korea is a place where women make much less money than men. The gender pay gap is quite high. But it's also a place where birth rates are about as low as anywhere on Earth for all of human history. So the idea that you know, feminism or women's liberation is strongly correlated with lower birth rates just doesn't actually match the data. And you see this too in like rich countries, OECD countries, which just means like rich countries of the world. The countries where the pay gap between men and women is larger, or where housework is more unequally divided, where men play less of a role in housework or child rearing, these are places that today have lower birth rates, not higher birth rates, lower birth rates. So it just isn't actually empirically, you know, set aside the sort of like moral abomination that would be rolling back the clock on gender progress. It just is empirically false that places today that are more unequal with fewer opportunities for women are places where birth rates are higher. It's just not true.
I'm going to play a voicemail that we got earlier. Let's give a listen.
Hi, my name is Janae. I'm a longtime listener, longtime supporter of CPR. I think it's absolutely absurd to even ask the question, how can we stop the decline of the population here in, literally anywhere in the world, right? How about pay people a living wage? How about support parents through affordable health care and affordable child care? The question is absurdly simple that it seems almost insulting to ask. It seems morally abhorrent to birth children into a world where they cannot be safe at school, it seems morally inept to birth children in a world where you are going to later have to depend on them in your later years because pensions and 401ks and retirement means nothing these days. It feels morally wrong to birth children into a world that we're literally killing.
Killing the planet that got cut off. So, Michael Jerusso, there seems to be this idea that we're moving towards a dystopian future. Why bring a child into that?
Yeah, so we especially hear this kind of concern in the U.S., you know, where employees have fewer protections than elsewhere, where, you know, we don't have, say, universal health care. I think the caller also mentioned childcare, where, you know, childcare is a scramble, where it's expensive. But let's just be really clear here. Birth rates are even lower in countries with greater social safety nets, more regulated economies. So in the economies of Europe, where you know, workers have more protection, where healthcare is universally socially provided, where childcare is heavily subsidized and for many people completely free. And, you know, more than both subsidized and free, it has been an investment to make it more available so that it's not a scramble to actually find the childcare in these places where, you know, the social safety net in old age is strong, in these places where college tuition is free. These are not places where people are having higher fertility rates, more babies than here in the United States. The experience of Scandinavian countries, for example, is lower birth rates than the United States. So while I completely agree that we should be doing things to make life better and easier and fairer for parents. And, you know, I've worked in my career outside of demography, working on trying to make the Medicare system, the Medicaid system, our socialized health insurance programs for the elderly and low-income Americans, respectively, better. And I think that's an important thing to pursue. I think we should not get too wrapped around the idea that if we were to do these things, that birth rates would increase, because we have a lot of evidence that that would not be the case.
Yeah, but people do talk about the fact I didn't have another child because of the childcare situation, because we couldn't afford it. I wanted another child, but we didn't do that because of our economic realities. It seems to be something that I hear all the time.
Yeah, and I hear it too. And I think we should take that seriously when we hear it. But I think we also have to give a real skeptical eye at the data and what the data tell us when we compare places and times where people have more versus fewer resources, and where, you know, the cost of childcare and other inputs to you know, sustaining a family are different. So, you know, just to put a fine point on this, if you look either across countries or across time, it's not the people in the richest places or the richest times that are having larger families. People in poorer countries tend to have more babies, not fewer babies. Poorer people within the same country tend to have more babies, not fewer babies. Maybe you think affordability is about prices, not incomes. But you know, childcare is expensive, healthcare is expensive. But in the places and times when childcare and healthcare become more affordable, often by government intervention, that might make life better for parents, and it might make life better for children. And, you know, on Medicaid in particular, there's a lot of evidence in the United States that Medicaid does a lot of good for children. And that in itself would be a reason to support Medicaid, for example, in the United States. But there is not evidence that that lowering the cost of these things, healthcare, childcare, actually causes birth rates to rise. So people say this, and there is a sense in which children are more expensive than they used to be, but it's not really in the prices, and it's not really, you can't find it in our incomes. It's in that the world around us is getting better decade by decade. There's more opportunity to do more things with their lives, to pursue more things outside of family life, and that is good. But it also means that parenting is a tougher comparison. It's giving up more to have a child now than perhaps it's ever been, because the world has more to offer us. And right. So that's a that's a tough problem to solve.
We can talk about that opportunity cost when we come back from the break. Our phone line, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Why do you think we have a people deficit after this spike? Stay tuned. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about depopulation in the planet. The birth rate in most parts of the world is too low to sustain the population, so we're seeing a contraction there. We're joined by one of the co-authors of the new book, After the Spike, Population Progress and the Case for People, Michael Jaruso. So let's talk about the pace of having babies. I mean, you're talking about generation by generation, but, you know, you can have babies at, I don't know, 16, and then, you know, a decade or two later, if you wanted, I guess. You know, I mean, is that also part of the deal?
Well, it's certainly been the case that over recent decades, parents have been delaying fertility further and further to later ages. So there have been, you know, more children being born to mothers in their 30s and 40s than in past decades, and fewer children being born to women in their 20s and teens than in past decades. And of course, you know, I think many of us would look at that trend of fewer teen births as something to praise rather than to be concerned about. That's certainly our position. Thinking about not teen births, but fewer births in the 20s, more births in the 30s and 40s, does mean that as parents and families are deciding whether to have another kid, to have a second or a third, they do get squeezed against the sort of biological limits that face us all. And that's something that you know, my family has experienced in trying to achieve our desired fertility, as the phrase goes among demographers. So that delay, you know, that delay is part of a larger social shift to spending more time in education, to trying to build up careers before setting down the path of making a family or even maybe making a partnership. So I think that is part of this story, although I don't think it's the whole story.
How many kids you got?
I have just one, and the story of how we ended up with one not more is a story that we tell in the book, but just to say a bit about it, I think like many people, you know, my wife and I, we had big plans for our careers in public service, and we had a lot that we wanted to do in life, and a kid didn't fit in exactly right away, so we had our first child in our 30s, and then struggled from there to have more. You know, and we're pretty happy. I don't really have many regrets, but this, you know, delay is something that can make it hard to achieve the families that people ultimately want to achieve.
Why don't we talk more about the joy of parenthood?
Yeah, I don't know. I think you need a different researcher on to discuss that. You know, sort of like a cultural anthropologist to interrogate.
I mean,
isn't
that
why
a factor,
is it
that we though? Don't... We don't. I mean, it's one of the greatest things you can do is to be a parent.
It's certainly one of the greatest things that I've ever done, and it's something I enjoy immensely. There does seem to be a taboo to, you know, talk. Or at least an inclination against talking positively about the experience of parenting, because
why? What taboo?
Seems like, I don't know. It does seem like there are, for some people, it's you know, you're sort of it's important to, you know, acknowledge that things are hard, and if you're not acknowledging that things are hard for some people, then you're sort of you're not I don't know, you're not following the right cultural script. Again, I think we should have a sociologist on for that.
Is that part of the
problem? I don't know. I don't know if that's part of the problem. You know, this falls in the bucket of things where, boy, it seems plausible. But I haven't seen studies that show that there's a real causal link here between the kind of stories that we tell in our cultures and societies about, you know, raising children as positive versus difficult experiences, and birth rates ultimately. And as an empirical economist, I want to always be skeptical about seeing the data before subscribing, you know, endorsing too readily a theory that sounds good. Because, for example, the affordability hypothesis sounds good. The idea that people just can't afford kids anymore really sounds like it rings true for many of us, but the data don't support it in the way that would back that up. And so I'm always a little bit skeptical before I see the numbers.
It seems like urbanization is also one of the drivers. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. As people move to the cities, it's harder to have bigger families in the cities. When you live in a rural area, you have kids and the kids become part of your labor force. But in rural parts of Texas, we see expanding childcare deserts, or, you know, it's harder to have a child in rural parts of Texas because there's so few people to have children that they don't have, you know, the resources and the medical resources to do that. And so the fewer people who are having children in these areas, the harder it is to have children. That seems to be a self-reinforcing issue.
Do you think there's something that's self-reinforcing about seeing what the people around you are doing, and having that be part of the, you know, the expectations that you're setting for yourself, that your family is setting for you, that your friends are setting for you? None of us make these decisions exactly on our own. And so the world that we see around us, and whether that means what other people are doing and sort of how children can fit into a full life, but also the resources that are available. You mentioned the availability of childcare, but just in general, the ability to sort of live a full and happy life, and make parenting and children a big part of that. You know, I think that is something that does depend on what we see around us and the resources we have around us.
I have an email comment says, the U.S. has a very simple solution to population decline: make immigrants legal. We have lots of people who are quite willing to do the jobs that citizens are not willing to do: construction, manual labor, yard work, housework, childcare, old age care. We do not have a population problem. So work off that.
Sure. So I think it's, first of all, just it's right that the United States in particular is in a special position where, if we chose, we really have access to immigrants who would love to come here, who would love to work here, who would love to join this country. One thing that I want to be clear about is that what we're interested in the book is not the fortunes of any one country. You know, depopulation is something that's going to matter for everyone everywhere. And so we're not taking on the narrow perspective of one country, one community, one culture, one generation. What's coming is bigger and longer term. That's global depopulation. And when the world shrinks, there's no immigration to or from planet Earth. And so immigration is something that just is not going to even factor into this long-term challenge. But on the question of the United States, I think that's right. You know, a fast solution to any problem with a shortage of workers is immigration. A fast solution, by the way, to any problem with, you know, needing more scientific innovation to make the progress that makes lives better is to do better funding of science through organizations in the U.S. like the NIH or the National Science Foundation. Thinking about birth rates globally and over the long term is really thinking about a different type of problem. I'll say one more word about immigration, because I think it might be surprising to many of our listeners here in Texas. And I think it was surprising even to me, even as a demographer, when I first started to understand these facts. Low fertility is really, truly a global phenomenon. It's true in religious and secular places in the world. It's true in rich countries, middle-income countries, poorer countries. You know, the birth rate in Texas is 1.8 kids per two adults. The birth rate in Mexico is 1.6. The birth rate in Brazil is lower. The birth rate in Colombia is something like one kid per two adults, like China. So is the birth rate in Chile. So I think sometimes we think of other countries, including Latin American countries, as having relatively high birth rates, but that's just Although that would have been true not very long ago, it's not true anymore. Even countries like India, which was once the center of fears and doom-mongering about overpopulation, is now a country with below replacement fertility, fewer than two kids per two adults. So whatever's been true in recent decades about immigration, even the sending countries are soon or already experiencing low fertility. That's going to change the calculus of immigration in ways that I don't think anyone can very accurately predict.
I mean, I can see a future where the United States would see itself in competition for immigration, trying to figure out a way to get people to come here rather than what we're doing now, which is making legal immigration harder and illegal immigration catastrophic. But the reason why the U.S. population has continued to grow, even though we've had declining birth rates, is because of immigration. And correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, it seems like new immigrants to the United States tend to have large families.
So on the first point, that's right. The reason that the United States has a growing population at all at this point is because of immigration.
That's a good thing.
I think immigration on the merits is good for the sending country. It's good for the immigrants themselves, and it's good for the receiving country. I think there's lots of evidence that say that social welfare overall is improved by immigration. You know, in the same way that, or at least in an analogous way that that we're all often made better off by things like global trade. That, you know, we don't live in a zero-sum world. That you know, immigration can make us better off. It can make immigrants' lives better off. You know, Europe, which also has relatively low fertility, not so different from the United States, its population has shrunk in recent years. It's sort of
I'm up against the break here, Michael. So
okay.
Get to this 1 minute break. We'll come back. We'll also get some callers on the air. 833-877-8255. The Source continues. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Michael Geruso. He is an economic demographer, a public economist, associate professor of economics at the University of Texas at Austin, co-author of the book After the Spike, Population, Progress, and the Case for People. And Dean Spears is the other co-author. Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Michael. Hey, Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. What can we learn from Israel that still has a high population rate?
Great question, Michael. Thank you. So Israel, lessons?
Yeah, so to put this in perspective, Israel today, as of the last day that I've seen, has a birth rate of about 2.9, so considerably higher than Europe, the United States, many countries in Southeast Asia, most countries, outside of Sub-Saharan Africa. I'm not sure how generalizable the example of Israel is. It's really hard to know what exactly within Israeli society is driving high birth rates. I mean, you might think that it's something about the sort of ultra-Orthodox because family sizes are very large there. But even among the non-ultra-Orthodox, Israeli birth rates are much higher than in peer countries with similar income levels. Exactly why that is actually quite difficult to tease out, and I'm not sure anyone. I don't think I've seen a very clear answer to that. But I think this is the sort of question that we should be asking, where we see differences across countries, where we see differences over time, where we see differences across communities. What is it that's causing these differences? Why are, you know, to take a less extreme example, why are birth rates in France twice those of South Korea? And you know, one of the things that we hope happens for this book is that researchers invest more in trying to pick apart the causes and effects here. But I think we actually don't have a very clear accounting right now, and not for Israel in particular.
So in France, they have put resources into trying to change this trend of childcare credits, money for people to have babies, all sorts of programs. They've seen a little bit of change in their birth rate, but not much. They haven't solved the problem.
That's right. But also South Korea has been trying things as well. I mean, in a way that sort of, you know, wouldn't really even make sense to us as Americans, the notion that the birth rate, the low birth rate is a huge problem.
I mean, Trump wants to give everyone $1,000 to have a baby.
Sure. But so, you know, in South Korea, though, it would be both the Liberal and Conservative Party, the vast majority would agree that low birth rates are a problem, whereas there would be more agreement with that among conservatives in the United States than liberals. But either of those groups would not have such a resounding agreement with the notion that low birth rates are a problem. So I think, you know, it's less politically polarized elsewhere in the world than it is here.
Hey, Bruce, let's get you on the air, Bruce. Bruce, you're on the air.
Great, thank you. The conversation, as I've heard it so far, is why birth rates are so low and what can be done about the problem. But I wonder if, in a more macro sense, it really is a problem. We look at it as a problem because we have to have the greater and greater growth rates to sustain the population that's already here. But on the other hand, the population, the world population that we already have is chewing up resources at an unsustainable level. So maybe we could talk a minute or two about whether this really is a problem independently from the idea of having to maintain what we already have.
All right, Bruce, thank you for that. So, Michael, is this a problem that's being solved if we're chewing through resources, as Bruce says?
Yeah, well, I want to say two things here. First, let me go to a second point that I think he was alluding to, which is sort of endless population growth in order to sustain more and more growth in our economies, in our living standards. I think something that I've probably done a poor job of being clear about today is that the thing that we're hoping for and advocating for is stabilizing at some level, possibly a much smaller level than today. So, you know, if for Bruce, if the idea is that, boy, we'd be so much better off with a population of 2 billion people than the present 8 billion people, I'm not sure I agree with that. But if we were to stipulate that that was the case, it would still be true that in the future, we would want birth rates to rise. So in order to stabilize at any level, even a tiny population or something much smaller than today, it would have to be the case that birth rates rose to an average of 2 kids per 2 adults. Because whether the population is big, small, or tiny, it would keep shrinking indefinitely as long as birth rates stayed below 2.
Where does population crash?
Yeah, so I'm not sure, and I don't think anyone can say exactly what's going to break in a world population that falls decade after decade, century after century. But, you know, just to give a sense of the pace of this, in a world where birth rates had converged globally to an average of 1.5, so not very different from the US or Europe today, and higher than Southeast Asia, in that world, the global population would decline 2/3 every century. So we would shrink by 2/3 every century. Oh. And it's in nobody's you know, science or capabilities to be able to predict exactly what's going to break in a world that is falling so quickly or exactly how the break is going to come. But I think you're right in thinking that something would break. And so, you know, what we're saying here is that change is probably is coming faster than you might imagine, and that we should be afraid of something breaking, even though no one could put their finger on exactly where something would break. Is it when the population falls below 4 billion or 3 billion or some other number?
Let's go to Miguel. Miguel, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Hey, my question was, what, you know, our state, you know, our government here in America, what is it that they think is going to happen, though, if the cost of living and the cost of raising children and taking care of them? I mean, my family, we've got 4 young kids, and for daycare for 2 of the littlest ones, you know, every month I'm paying over $1,000 a month, just cash. It's not subsidized. That's just what we have to come up with. You know, at what point does the government say we need to lower these costs or do something for these people so that we can continue to have a nation? You know, thank you.
Well, we had somebody running for president who was promising to fix some of that. She didn't get elected. So I don't know if it's the government or the population who makes these decisions. But Michael?
Yeah, I think it is, if you share the idea that I do, that people are good for one another, and that parents are doing something important and in some sense altruistic in raising families, that that we should be sharing these burdens more broadly, that government societies should be doing more to help parents, to help fathers and mothers, to make it easier to combine parenthood, not only with other financial goals, but with everything else that matters to them, careers and education, friendships. And I think it's right that governments aren't doing enough, that societies aren't doing enough, that, but I also just want to be really clear that the evidence does not support the idea that, birth rates would shoot back up to replacement or above with the sort of social provision of childcare or generous tax credits that we see in some countries. So yes to doing more for parents, but I think we should expect those to have pretty modest effects on birth rates. And that shouldn't be a surprise, right? If someone said to you, I am going to give you $5,000 for you to marry somebody other than the person who you're married to change the person you're going to spend the rest of your life with, not a lot of us would take that deal. And so we shouldn't be surprised that parents, even though several thousand dollars would help, are not going to make different choices right. for one of the most intimate personal choices of their life about how many children to have because the government, sends a couple thousand dollars to them.
So really quickly, I'm going to squeeze in Jennifer. Jennifer, we're really short on time, but you're on the air.
Okay, I understand this is a worldwide trend, but I'm just wondering how extensive your research is. Is there not a single country or single region anywhere where that number is above 2.1?
All right, Jennifer, thank you for that. So Sub-Saharan Africa, is that what we're looking at, Michael?
So Sub-Saharan Africa is still far above replacement, but birth rates there are falling as well. So today, birth rates are about a little over four kids per woman or four kids per two adults on average. In 1990, they were, I think, upwards of five. And, 1950, they were up closer to six. So birth rates are falling there as well. And I think we should expect them to continue to fall as Africa continues on the path of development and sort of follows the same sort of path that other developing countries have followed as people have gotten richer, as female education has improved. But to the broader question, has there ever been a case of a rebound? The answer is no, not really. Since for as far back as we have good data to examine cohort fertility, how many kids does a woman have over her entire lifetime? There have been 26 countries where birth rates have ever fallen below 1.9, and in zero of those 26 countries have they ever risen up again to replacement levels. So that doesn't mean that it's hopeless, but it does mean that we have a lot of work to do, and nobody has the answer right now. But we also have a few decades before depopulation starts, and we should be using that time to correct the record on overpopulation, to correct the record that other people are good for you. They are not your competition. They're a source of abundance. They make life better for you. And we should be using this time to learn how we can support parents and how we can sort of undertake this generational project to make parenthood and raising children more compatible with everything else that we want to accomplish in our lives.
Michael Geruso, he is the co-author with Dean Spears of the book After the Spike, Population Progress and the Case for People. Michael, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Live long and prosper. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.